comfortable about the imprisonment of his son now that it seemed justified. When Alexander saw there was no way of shaking his father's belief, he determined to come to grips with his perils and composed a 4-volume indictment of his enemies, admitting the plot, but naming most of them as accomplices, of whom the chief were Pheroras and Salome. The latter, he alleged, had one night actually forced her way into his room and had intercourse with him against his will. These volumes, full of clamorous and dreadful allegations against the highest in the land, came into Herod's hands, and shortly after Archelaus made a hurried journey to Judea in alarm for his daughter and son-in-law. In assisting them, he showed remarkable tact, and by using guile he brought the king's threats to nothing. The moment he met him, he let fly, "Where is that perishing son-in-law of mine? Where shall I find that damned parasite? I will flay him alive with my own hands, and I will do the same to my daughter along with her charming husband. Even if she had no finger in the pie, she is his wife, and tarred with the same brush. I can't understand how you, the intended victim, can take it so calmly, if it is true that Alexander is still alive. I came full speed from Cappadocia, expecting to find he had paid the penalty long ago, and to ask your advice about my daughter, whom I gave away to that scoundrel because of your great name. But now we must put our heads together about the pair of them, and if you are too much of a father, or haven't the nerve to give your son what he deserves, we had better change places and carry out each other's sentences." Seeing the force of this argument, Herod, for a time, transferred his anger from Alexander to Pheroras, the chief villain of the 4 volumes. He, observing this sudden change in the king's attitude and his complete acceptance of the suggestions of his friend Archelaus, saw no hope of saving himself by honest means, so decided to do it by sheer impudence. He dropped Alexander and applied to Archelaus. That monarch answered that he didn't see how he could plead for a man mixed up in such a shady business, which made it as plain as could be that he had plotted against the king and brought all the lad's present troubles on him, unless he was prepared to abandon his tricks and denials and plead guilty to the crimes he was charged with, and then ask pardon of his brother, who was still fond of him. If he would do that, he would help him in every possible way. Pheroras took his advice, and after making careful preparations to look as woebegone as possible, clothed in black and with streaming eyes, grovelled at Herod's feet and begged for mercy, as he had done successfully on several previous occasions. He admitted he was a dirty scoundrel, guilty on every count, but blamed his unbalanced and frenzied state of mind, brought on, he said, by his passionate love for his wife. Having thus brought Pheroras to accuse and give evidence against himself, Archelaus now began to plead for him and mitigate Herod's anger by quoting parallels in his own house. Why, he himself had suffered much worse treatment at his brother's hands, but had never let revenge weaken the ties of blood. Kingdoms were like fat men. One member or another was always getting inflamed because of the weight it carried. But this called not for the surgeon's knife, but for a dose of medicine. These arguments, and others to the same effect, softened Herod's anger with Pheroras. But Archelaus continued to fume against Alexander, and insisted that he would divorce his daughter and take her home, until he brought Herod round to the point of pleading with him on the lad's behalf, and once more requesting the hand of his daughter for his son. With a most convincing appearance of sincerity, Archelaus gave him leave to marry her to anyone he pleased, except Alexander. He was most anxious to preserve the marriage links between himself and Herod. The king replied that he would be receiving back his son as a gift from him if he refrained from breaking the marriage. They already had children, and the lad was most devoted to his wife. If she stayed with him, she would help him to be ashamed of his misdeeds. But if she was torn from him, his despair would be complete. A reckless spirit was tamed when diverted by domestic affection. After long hesitation, Archelaus gave in, was reconciled to the young man, and reconciled his father to him. However, he said it was necessary to send him to Rome for an audience with Caesar, to whom he had himself dispatched a detailed report. Thus the stratagem by which Archelaus rescued his son-in-law was a complete success. After the reconciliation, they spent their time in feasting and mutual entertainment. When he said goodbye, Herod made him a present of 70 talents, a golden throne set with precious stones, eunuchs, and a concubine called Pinicus, and rewarded all his gentlemen according to their rank. By the king's command, all his counselors similarly gave Archelaus magnificent gifts. Finally, he was escorted by Herod and the nobility all the way to Antioch. Alas, it was not long before Judea was visited by a man who could do far more than the stratagems of Archelaus, and who not only brought to an end the reconciliation Archelaus had contrived for Alexander, but actually compassed that young man's destruction. He was a Laconian by birth, named Eurycles, whose intrusion into the kingdom was due to his passion for money. Greece no longer satisfied his extravagance. He brought splendid gifts for Herod as a bait to secure his ends, instantly receiving much bigger in return. But he had no use for a straightforward gift unless he could make profit out of the kingdom by bloodshed. So he got round the king by compliments, subtle suggestion, and hollow flattery. He quickly summed up Herod's character, and playing up to him in all he said and did, he soon became one of his closest friends. The king and all his court were only too glad to show special regard for this Spartan for his country's sake. He soon became thoroughly acquainted with the rotten state of the royal house, the brothers' quarrels, and their father's attitude to each. And, though Antipater, in view of his hospitality, had the first claim on his gratitude, he professed friendship for Alexander, falsely claiming that he had long been an intimate friend of Archelaus. This won him instant acceptance as a proved ally, and an early introduction to Alexander's brother Aristobulus. Playing first one part, and then another, in various ways he won the confidence of everybody, but his favorite roles were those of hireling to Antipater and traitor to Alexander. He cried shame on Antipater if he, the eldest son, stood by while other people were after his expectations, and on Alexander if he, whose mother and wife were king's daughter, allowed the crown to pass to a commoner's son, and that when he had the influential backing of Archelaus. The lad trusted him as a counselor, since he claimed the friendship of Archelaus. So, keeping nothing back, he told him of all the wrongs Antipater had done him, and of the likelihood that, after killing their mother, Herod would deprive him and his brother of her kingdom. With these grievances, the tender-hearted Eurycles pretended to sympathize. Then he tricked Aristobulus into saying the same things, and having involved both in criticism of their father, he went off to repeat their private conversation to Antipater, adding the lie that his brothers were after his blood and on the point of swooping on him sword in hand. These efforts having earned him a handsome dividend, he sang the praise of Antipater to his father. Finally, terms were agreed for him to compass the death of Aristobulus and Alexander, and he undertook to accuse them before their father. Presenting himself before Herod, he declared that he was offering him life in return for his kindness, the light of day to repay his hospitality. A sword had long since been sharpened against him, and Alexander had braced his arm. He himself had delayed the blow by feigned collaboration. He had heard Alexander say that Herod was not content to sit on a throne belonging to others, and after murdering their mother to squander her empire, but was actually dragging in a bastard as his successor and offering the kingdom of their grandfather to that worm Antipater. But he would take the law into his own hands and avenge the spirits of Hyrcanus and Mariamne. He would never stoop to succeed such a father on the throne without bloodshed. Day after day he was subjected to constant annoyance, so that he could not make the most casual remark without its being turned against him. If other people's ancestry was mentioned, his father went out of his way to make insulting remarks, such as, "Only Alexander has any ancestors. He thinks his father came out of the gutter." At the hunt, his very silence gave offense. If he paid a compliment, he was accused of sarcasm. Everywhere he found his father impossible to please, and with no feeling for anyone but Antipater. So he would gladly die if he failed in his attempt. If he succeeded, his safety was guaranteed, first by Archelaus, his father-in-law, to whom he could easily escape, then by Caesar, who was not yet aware of Herod's true character. He would not, as on a former occasion, stand before him intimidated by his father's presence, or confine himself to the discussion of his personal grievances. He would first of all openly proclaim the miseries of his people, bled white by taxation, and then reveal the luxuries and excesses on which all this blood money was spent, the sort of man enriched at the expense of himself and his brother, and the means by which certain towns had won privileges. And while he was there, he would demand an inquiry into the fate of his grandfather and his mother, and mercilessly expose the filth and corruption pervading the whole kingdom. There would be no question then of his being adjudged a parricide. When he had concluded this scandalous diatribe against Alexander, Eurycles delivered a lengthy eulogy of Antipater as the only son with any affection for his father, and for that reason an obstacle to the plot hitherto. The king, who had not yet got completely over the earlier shocks, boiled over with uncontrollable anger. Antipater again seized his chance and sent a fresh set of hush-hush informers to accuse his brothers of having held secret conferences with Jucundus and Tyrannus, once officers of the king's cavalry, but now, because of some offences, deprived of their commissions. At this, Herod lost his temper completely, and at once put the two men on the rack. They admitted none of the charges, but a letter was produced as sent by Alexander to the commandant at Alexandrium, requesting him to admit Aristobulus and himself to the fortress when he had killed their father, and to let them use the weapons and other resources of the place. Alexander protested that this letter had been forged by Diophantus, the king's secretary, a man without scruples and very clever at imitating any hand, who, after a lifetime of forgery, was ultimately executed for that very offense. Herod put the commandant to the torture, but failed to extract any information from him about the allegations. He found the evidence unconvincing, but nevertheless kept his sons under surveillance, though still at liberty. The curse of his house and stage manager of the whole filthy business, Eurycles, he called savior and benefactor and rewarded with 50 talents. Thus enriched, he did not wait for the truth to come out, but hurried off to Cappadocia, where he got money out of Archelaus too, by brazenly asserting that he had reconciled Herod to Alexander. Then, crossing to Greece, he employed his ill-gotten gains in promoting further mischief. Twice accused before Caesar of fostering sedition all over Achaia and fleecing the townships, he was deported. So he paid the penalty for what he had done to Alexander and Aristobulus. How different from the Spartan was Evarastus of Cos! one of Alexander's closest friends, he was in the country at the same time as Eurycles, and when the king put to him the allegations made by the latter, he declared on oath that he had not heard the youngsters say any such thing. But he could do nothing to help the unfortunate pair. Herod was only too eager to listen to evil tongues, and no others, and welcomed only men as gullible and irascible as himself. His savage treatment of his children received a further impetus from Salome, the aunt and mother-in-law of Aristobulus, who, wishing to involve her in his own dangers, sent her a hint to look after herself. The king, he said, was ready to kill her on the charge previously brought, that in her determination to wed the Arab Silius, she had treacherously disclosed to him the secrets of the king, his enemy. This proved to be the final gust that sent the storm-tossed youths to the bottom. Salome ran to the king and reported the hint she had received. Herod, finally giving way, put both his sons in fetters and in solitary confinement. Then, losing no time, he sent Volumnius, the military tribune, and one of the gentlemen, Olympus, to Caesar with Salome's report in writing. They sailed for Rome and delivered the king's dispatches. Caesar was very grieved for the youths, but did not think that he ought to undermine the father's authority over his sons. So he wrote back, leaving the matter to Herod's discretion, but recommending him to convene a joint committee of his own counselors and the provincial governors to inquire into the alleged conspiracy. If the charges were proved, he should put his sons to death. If they had merely intended to abscond, a lesser penalty would suffice. Accepting this suggestion, Herod went to Beirut, the place indicated by Caesar, and convened the court. In obedience to the emperor's written instructions, the bench was occupied by Roman officers, Saturninus and his legates, Padanius and another, together with Volumnius the procurator. Also present were the king's counselors and gentlemen, Salome and Pheroras, and finally the nobility of all Syria, with the sole exception of King Archelaus, who, as Alexander's father-in-law, was distrusted by Herod. The sons were not brought into court. Herod was too shrewd for that, knowing they had only to be seen to melt all hearts, and if in addition they were allowed to speak, Alexander would easily refute the charges. So they were kept in custody at Platana, a village near Sidon. The king rose, and, as if they were present, launched out into a bitter attack. His attempts to prove the charge of conspiracy were weak, owing to the lack of evidence, but he emphasized the insults, mocking speeches, outrages, and offenses without number directed against him, harder to bear than death itself, as he told the court. Then he invited his silent audience to pity him, in that he himself was the sufferer, even if he did win a bitter victory over his sons. Finally, he asked them for their several opinions. First to reply was Saturninus, who was for condemning the youths, but not to death. It would not be right for a man with three children in court to vote for the execution of another man's children. His two legates voted the same way, and several others followed their lead. Volumnius was the first to advocate the death sentence, and all who spoke after him were for condemning the lads to death, some from flattery, some from hatred of Herod, no one from conviction that the accused were guilty. And now all Syria and Judea were in suspense, waiting for the last scene of the drama. But no one guessed that Herod would be so barbarous as to murder his children. He, however, dragged his sons to Tyre, and after sailing from there to Caesarea, weighed the possible methods of putting the lads to death. There was an old soldier of the king, called Tyro, whose son was a bosom friend of Alexander, and who was very fond of both lads himself. He was so overcome with indignation that his reason gave way, and he went round shouting that justice had been trampled underfoot. Truth was no more, nature in confusion, life in a state of anarchy. And anything else that occurred to a man deeply moved and without a thought for his own life. At length he went boldly to the king. "You miserable wretch," he thundered, "that is what I think of you, to turn against your own flesh and blood at the bidding of utter scoundrels. Over and over again you have condemned Pheroras and Salome to death, and now you take their word against your children. Don't you see they are cutting off your legitimate heirs and leaving you with only Antipater, choosing a king they can twist round their little finger? Take care, take care, the army doesn't one day hate him as it hates you because of his brother's death. There is not one private who doesn't pity the lads, and many of the officers are cursing you openly." He proceeded to give their names, and the king at once arrested them, along with Tyro and his son. Directly after this, one of the court barbers, called Trypho, sprang forward in the grip of some frenzy, and informed against himself. "I am in it too," he shouted. "Tyro here told me to cut your throat with my razor when I was shaving you, and promised that Alexander would pay me well." Hearing this, Herod examined Tyro, with his son and the barber, on the rack, and when the first two denied everything and the other had nothing to add, ordered Tyro to be racked still more severely. At last the son, greatly distressed, promised to tell the king everything if he would spare his father. And when Herod agreed, he stated that his father had been persuaded by Alexander to plan his death. Some people thought that he had made this up in order to end his father's agony, others that it was true. Herod called a mass meeting, at which he accused the officers and Tyro, and enlisted the help of the people to dispose of them. Along with the barber, they were killed then and there with clubs and stones. Then he sent his sons to Sebaste, which was not far from Caesarea, giving orders that they should be strangled. The order being instantly carried out, he gave instructions for the bodies to be brought to the fortress of Alexandrium, to be buried by the side of Alexander, their mother's